This is Thursday, December 22nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Ira Melman. I'm in Washington, D.C. Coming up, Berlin starts to return to normal as it reopens its Christmas marketplace, the scene of an attack this week.
We would like to see where it happens, show some support, some respect to people who lost their lives.
The search is now on for a suspect from Tunisia in that attack. Also ahead, Dorian Jones joins us from Turkey in the aftermath of the assassination of the Russian ambassador. And you'll hear about what Russia claims is a widening gap between them and the United States. All on today's International Edition. The Christmas market in Berlin that saw 12 people killed by a radical jihadist in a large truck Monday is reopened with a heavy police presence and concrete barriers installed around its edges. The event's organizers made the decision to reopen the market without party music or bright lights, which have been replaced by candles and flowers left at the site of the attack as tribute for those that were killed. Tourists are also being drawn to the scene, as these two are from the Netherlands.
We would like to see where it happens, show some support, some respect to people who lost their life over here.
Yeah, just to see the place. And, well, we're surprised that it's open right now because it just happened like 2 days ago.
And quite busy.
Meanwhile, authorities are engaged in a manhunt across Europe in search of a 24-year-old Tunisian man whom German officials say should have been deported months ago. Anis Amri, the top suspect in the attack, was a rejected asylum seeker who had been under police surveillance following a tip he might try to buy weapons for a possible attack. But that investigation was dropped in September. His asylum application was denied 6 months ago, but he was not sent back to Tunisia because of problems with his documents. Those revelations have renewed questions in Germany about how the country vets the thousands of people who have entered the country looking for asylum. German Chancellor Angela Merkel said a day after the attack it would be hard to bear if an asylum seeker were responsible. That's the situation in Berlin. Let's check out social media now. Andrew Palshevsky is with us, and what's trending highly today?
Well, we've got two stories, one about how people are using social media in kind of an awful way, and one in which they're using it in a positive way. So we'll get the bad one out of the way first, and it involves Vanity Fair editor Kurt Eichenwald, who's written about Donald Trump and been critical of him, and he's attracted a lot of hate on social media. Now, someone actually sent him on Twitter something that he clicked on. It was an animation, a flashing animation, and that actually caused him to have a seizure because Eichenwald has epilepsy. And when you view flashing images or flashes, when you have epilepsy, it can cause you to have a seizure. And that's indeed what happened. And this was something that someone sent him on Twitter as a message, couldn't see what it was before he opened it. And that was the result. Now, that is something that Twitter is investigating, and they're saying they're working to try to find out who sent this and who that person was. But really troubling that social media can even have a physical impact like that on somebody, not just an emotional impact.
Also, that just brings up everything we talk about on a daily basis, and that is the dichotomy of what is free speech and what is protection for the rest of the population.
And this might be the line where it's crossed, because he had an epileptic seizure and actually a physical response to this, that it actually harmed him. So this might be a landmark case in social media where we see maybe someone being prosecuted for assault or battery because of what they sent on social media, even though there was no physical contact. So we'll continue to report on that as that develops. But we'll get to the good story, because we've got the holidays coming up, so I want to focus on something nice. And it doesn't sound good from the onset, but trust me, it is. The Twitter accounts for Marvel Studios and Netflix were hacked by a group known as OurMine, O-U-R-M-I-N-E. Now, it doesn't sound like a good thing that they got hacked, but what this group does, they call themselves White Hat Hackers. What they do is they go into Twitter accounts for companies and entities, they hack into them, and then they tweet out and say, "Hey, it's us. Don't worry. We're just testing your security. contact us, we'll tell you more about it, and then they list an email address. So what they say they do is they hack in to show companies where they have weaknesses, and then they work with them to improve their security. So they're actually using hacking for good.
It's just like the guys you've seen over and over again, the former safecrackers.
Exactly.
You know, who are hired by the safe companies to come in and show them exactly what's going on and how they're doing. It's exactly the same thing.
It's exactly the same thing, except it's all online now, and except the companies didn't hire them to do this. So that's kind of where it gets into a murky area, that they go out and find these vulnerabilities on their own. But I think at the end of the day, the companies are glad to improve their security.
I got a murky area for you. You know how people, a lot of people get depressed during this holiday season?
Yeah, the darkness and less light here in the Northern Hemisphere.
Well, here's a new study out of the University of Pittsburgh Center for Research on the Media, Technology, and Health. It says heavy usage of social media can lead to depression. Says the use of multiple platforms is more strongly associated with depression and anxiety among young adults specifically. Researchers found that people who report using between 7 and 11 social media platforms are 3 times more likely to develop depression and anxiety than those who use between 0 and 2 platforms.
And you know now, what it boils
you,
down
you
to?
You use around 50 platforms.
Huh? I'm still happy, though, for the time being. But you know what it boils down to? 4 letters, F-O-M-O, FOMO, fear of missing out. Because people put their best moments from their lives on social media, vacation pics, pictures with friends and families out at restaurants having a great time. And when people look at that, they think, well, my life doesn't look that good. But that's because it's a very curated little slice of their life that you're getting a glimpse into. So that's part of the reason why.
So you should just take it from me. You know, I don't want anybody else except my family to know what I'm doing. I don't want anybody to know where I'm going on vacation. I don't want to post any pictures or anything like that. I'm an old guy, and that's the way it is, and I'm happy.
And you're much happier for it, so there you go.
There you go. Andrew Palcheski, who is not in a period of depression, at least yet, and we'll keep tap on how he's feeling and what's going on.
So far, so good.
Well, we'll talk to you again tomorrow, okay?
All right.
This is International Edition. Among the top stories, the Christmas market in Berlin that saw 12 people killed by a radical jihadist in a large truck on Monday has reopened with a heavy police presence and concrete barriers installed around its edges. The International Committee of the Red Cross says it expects evacuations for thousands of Syrians still waiting to leave Aleppo and throughout the day, but cautioned that bad weather is slowing that process. Russia mourns its slain ambassador to Turkey at a ceremony at the foreign ministry in Moscow. And Donald Trump's transition team says the president-elect has selected Kellyanne Conway as counselor to the president, making her the highest-ranking woman in his White House. More on these stories on the VOAnews.com website and on our VOA mobile apps. This is International Edition, and this is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
The Earth's core, which lies nearly 3,000 kilometers below the surface, is made of two layers. At the very center of the Earth is the inner core, which scientists say is a solid sphere made of an iron-nickel alloy. Surrounding the inner core is the outer core, which is made of molten iron and nickel that's believed to be between 4,000 and 5,000 degrees Celsius. New data gathered by the European Space Agency's 3-satellite swarm network is providing scientists with an X-ray view of the Earth's core. This information has led to the discovery of a jet stream flowing within the molten outer core. Like the jet stream of air currents flowing in the atmosphere, scientists explain that this jet stream in the outer core is a moving belt of molten material circling its magnetic North Pole and traveling at a speed of about 40 kilometers per year. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Russia's mourning its slain ambassador to Turkey at a ceremony Thursday at the foreign ministry in Moscow. An off-duty police officer shot Ambassador Andrei Karlov Monday in Ankara. Karlov's coffin was surrounded by wreaths and a military honor guard. His seated family members looked on from the side and people approached to pay their respects. Among the dignitaries in attendance were President Vladimir Putin, Prime Minister Dmitry Medvedev, and Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan says the assassination was no doubt carried out by a member of the network of Muslim cleric Fethullah Gulen. Joining us now is Dorian Jones, who is in Istanbul for VOA. And Dorian, what about the investigation into the assassination of the Russian ambassador? What's happening?
Well, they are still focusing on whether the assassin was part of the Fethullah Gulen organization, known as FETÖ in Turkey. They have, all the investigation at the moment is focusing very just on that particular angle of investigation, although six members of the family of the assassin have been released. But the president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, again today underlined that he believed that this was part of a conspiracy organized by Gulen, who does live in self-imposed exile in the United States. Gulen has issued a denial, saying he had no part in this. And it has to be said also that al-Nusra earlier in the week gave an announcement saying that they were behind this attack. Now, this has been dismissed out of hand by Turkish authorities. They say that this is fake news. And in fact, the Minister of Defense in Parliament refused to even answer questions over the al-Nusra's claim of responsibility. So for now, at least, the government and Turkish authorities seem to be totally focused on the idea that it was Gulen who has been blamed for the July failed military coup. Has been responsible. This is part of another attempt by what they say is a conspiracy to undermine Turkey and its relations with other countries.
Which opens up what has become somewhat of a gap between Turkey and the United States. Is that correct?
Well, that is it. And in fact, much of the pro-government media in Turkey are pointing fingers at the United States, suggesting they were somehow involved in this conspiracy as well. They say that this deepening relationship between Ankara and Washington and Moscow is not viewed favorably in the United States, and they say that in some way the United States are trying to undermine that. But it is the case, certainly, that in the last few months, relations have markedly improved between Ankara and Moscow. You have to recall that last year, relations hit rock bottom when Turkish jets shot down a Russian bomber operating in Syria. But now it does seem that two countries are working together, and what is bringing them together is Syria. Both countries realize that they need one another to resolve this conflict. Turkey being a key supporter of the rebels, whereas Moscow is supporting the Assad regime, and they realize they have to work together. And this already is providing results. The Aleppo evacuation of refugees was made possible by the two countries working together, and the two countries in a meeting earlier this week in Moscow with Iran participation as well are saying they're working together for a wider ceasefire and ultimately looking for an end game, an end solution. And most notably about all of this is Washington is being excluded from these talks.
Well, you mentioned Syria, and we will talk about the evacuation of Aleppo in just a moment or so. But there are headlines today as far as Turkish troops in Syria. Is that correct?
Well, that's right. Turkey's forces are in Syria. Operation Euphrates Shield, they're there for two purposes. One, to block further gains by Syrian Kurds, who Turkey feel are on the verge of creating a Syrian Kurdish state on its border, and also against Islamic State as well. And currently, Turkish soldiers, along with the Free Syrian Army, are engaged in a heavy battle to capture the strategic town of Al-Bab. Now, this is key to ultimately taking Raqqa, the capital, self-declared capital of Islamic State. But Al-Bab is being ferociously defended by several thousand Islamic State militants. And in one incident, we understand a suicide bomber approached a large number of Turkish soldiers, killed at least 16 and injured 30 others, three seriously. And this is the most serious loss of life since Operation Euphrates Shield started in July. We're getting reports that the fighting to take Al-Bab is the most serious and ferocious that the Turkish forces have faced, involving daily suicide bombing attacks. But this is by far the most deadly. And experts I spoke to are warning that this could be the beginning of a very bloody and bitter struggle to take Al-Bab. Islamic State saying they're not going to give it up without a struggle. And Turkish forces are now suffering the consequences of this ferocious battle, which shows no signs of ending.
Dorian Jones reporting from Istanbul from VOA. Once again, Dorian, thanks for being with us. And we told you we would talk about what is happening in and around Aleppo. The International Committee of the Red Cross says it expects evacuations for thousands of Syrians still waiting to leave Aleppo and a pair of villages under rebel siege in Idlib province to go on throughout the day and into the night, but caution that bad weather is slowing that process. An ICRC spokeswoman said earlier Thursday heavy snow, wind, and freezing temperatures could push the operation even longer than that. The ICRC is helping with the evacuations and said by Thursday about 34,000 people have left eastern Aleppo, which rebels held for 4 years, in their effort to push President Bashar al-Assad from office. That figure includes 4,000 rebel fighters who left overnight. Now, once this evacuation effort is complete, Assad's government will have full control of Aleppo, the country's most populous city before the war, for the first time since 2012. And also yesterday, the UN General Assembly adopted a resolution to set up an independent panel to investigate possible war crimes in the nearly six-year-old Syrian conflict. VOA's International Edition continues now. The Kremlin says that communications with the United States are frozen. This from an interview with a government spokesman on Mir TV. VOA's Arash Arabasadi in Washington has more on that.
Chilling news from the Kremlin Wednesday that communications with the United States are frozen. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov told regional broadcaster Mir TV that almost every level of dialogue with the United States is frozen and that the countries don't communicate with one another except minimally. The State Department countered that just a day earlier the two countries spoke about Syria.
Certainly on the major issues and the issues that matter most, there continues to be dialogue. So I'm just not sure what to make of his comment. That's certainly not reflective of the way we see communications between Moscow and Washington.
The news comes one day after the U.S. sanctioned more Russian businesses over the annexation of Crimea and the ongoing conflict with Ukraine. It also comes just a few weeks before President Obama's administration moves out and President Trump's moves in. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News, Washington.
Well, Russian President Vladimir Putin is on the stand again today. He is speaking out about his country, and he is saying that Russia's military today can overpower any potential foe. He said, "We can say with certainty we're stronger now than any potential aggressor. Anyone," he said. His comments came at the end of a year when tensions between Russia and the West have remained on edge over the civil war in Syria. Tensions between Russia and the West, as we just told you, have been souring ever since Russia's 2014 annexation of Crimea and the surreptitious support of separatists in eastern Ukraine. More as information becomes available. This is VOA.
VOA Special English. A way to learn American English and much more. Broadcasting a half hour of world news and features every day on radio. You can also find Special English on television and online at voaspecialenglish.com. For 50 years, helping people understand world events and the language and culture of America.
Are you suffering from heartache? No problem. We've got the cure for you. The African beat can soothe your heartache with its awesome tunes from the African continent. So join me, David Van Dee, Mondays through Fridays at 0900 and 2000 Universal Time for a healing journey. I guarantee it.
Here on International Edition, we shift the focus to the Far East. South Korea impeached President Park Geun-hye last week after 2 months of public outcry over alleged involvement in an influence-peddling scheme. While the fate of her presidency is now in the hands of the 9-member Constitutional Court, VOA Steve Miller takes a look at what may become of her hard-fought policies.
South Korean President Park Geun-hye awaits an uncertain political fate as her impeachment is adjudicated by the country's constitutional court. While an overwhelming number of South Koreans want her removed from office, it's unclear how these events will impact a number of Park's programs, like the controversial bilateral intelligence sharing pact with Tokyo and deployment of the Terminal High Altitude Area Defense Missile System made by the United States, known as THAAD. While the opposition Minju Party would like to see the THAAD system delayed, Acting President Hwang Kyo-ahn says the system should be deployed as soon as possible. Catherine Moon, a non-resident fellow at the Brookings Institution and professor at Wellesley College, says on Skype, that isn't unexpected.
I think the impeachment proceedings have expedited the plans to install THAAD. That's just the bottom line. And the reason, obviously, is people don't know what will happen in the coming months.
And that, Moon says, may open an opportunity for the opposition presidential candidate Moon Jae-in to change the agreement with the United States regarding its implementation. But it may be too soon for the opposition to count on any changes to be made. Via Skype, Daniel Pinkston, a lecturer on international relations at Troy University, notes there is a huge difference between criticizing those in charge and being there yourself.
When someone becomes president and is responsible for the territorial integrity of the Republic of Korea, the safety and security of the people and all assets in the country, that's quite serious responsibility, very solemn responsibility.
In November, South Korea and Japan signed an intelligence sharing pact, something that was originally supposed to go into effect in 2012, but was scrapped due to domestic opposition. The new deal has also faced criticism. However, the bilateral agreement has already started. Daniel Pinkston.
I understand the resentment from the colonial period and so forth. However, on the other hand, these agreements are pretty standard. It only provides for a channel or a mechanism to share sensitive information and to protect that information and protect the sources and methods.
Catherine Moon agrees.
It's in place. It's working. And in truth, both countries benefit immensely.
Daniel Pinkston says that South Korea has many such agreements and that this one doesn't require Seoul to do anything. It only provides a channel of communication. So if there was a threat from North Korea and Japan had valuable intelligence, Pinkston doesn't
understand why any leader or government official who's responsible for the security of South Korea would refuse that information.
With Catherine Moon adding,
by no means is South Korea giving away the store.
South Korea's Constitutional Court has convened to begin hearing the impeachment case against President Park. While the court must arrive at its conclusion within 180 days, the fate of Park's public policy may remain unknown for an indiscriminate amount of time. Steve Miller, VOA News, Washington.
That wraps up the program. I'm Ira Melvin in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
United Nations officials, including Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, are warning of possible genocide in South Sudan as terrible violence rages there. The Secretary General is urging the Security Council to impose an arms embargo on the country to remove the tools to escalate violence, a position the United States supports, in addition to establishing targeted sanctions on individuals responsible for some of the worst atrocities in the conflict. South Sudan gained its independence from Sudan in 2011. In 2013, a civil war broke out, and the country descended into sectarian violence when forces loyal to President Salva Kiir, a member of the Dinka ethnic community, began to fight those who supported former Vice President Riek Machar, an ethnic Nuer. A peace accord was signed in 2015, but the fighting has continued, leading to a humanitarian disaster with widespread displacement and food insecurity, as well as pervasive human rights abuses, including the systematic use of sexual violence as a weapon of war. In a statement, U.S. State Department spokesperson John Kirby said that both the government and the opposition are responsible for the horrific violence that has brought so much suffering to innocent civilians. He pointed to the recent mobilization of 4,000 government-affiliated militia in central Equatoria and to repeated calls from opposition leaders to overthrow the government and attack the capital. Both the government and opposition, Mr. Kirby said, continue to obstruct humanitarian access and impede the operation of the UN mission in South Sudan, or UNMISS, And despite pledges to do so, the government has not taken sufficient steps to allow deployment of an UNMISS regional protection force to provide stability and security in Juba. Mr. Kirby took note of President Kiir's December 14th call for a national dialogue and called on both sides to create the conditions that would be required for such a dialogue to proceed. This means that both sides must cease violence against civilians, support humanitarian access, and respect the ceasefire. Mr. Kirby urged the swift adoption by the UN Security Council of an arms embargo and targeted sanctions against those who have undermined peace and stability and created the conditions for mass civilian atrocities. As we and our partners in the international community continue to pursue these measures, we will support those engaging in a peaceful and inclusive dialogue as a means to resolve the current crisis and work toward the peaceful future that the people of South Sudan deserve.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.